back, everybody, to the Brexit podcast. I'm your host, Tim Hemming, and joining me today is a guest who is actually recommended by one of our previous guests, who's Pete North. Pete's from the Leave Alliance. You can listen to his views in episode 104, but Pete's very well informed on Brexit. So when he suggested getting on as spokesperson for Scientists for EU, I thought it'd be good to jump at the chance. So joining me today is Dr. Mike Goldsworthy. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you for joining us. Mike, I just had a quick look on your Twitter feed before the call, and the latest tweet from Scientists for EU is, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics, and a bit of a pause, and then remove quantum mechanics and insert Brexit. So I think a lot of people would agree with that, certainly. But look, I guess it might be, you know, name on the tin type stuff, but can you just tell me, give me the escalator pitch, what are Scientists for EU?
Right. Well, we set up Scientists for EU, myself and my colleague Rob Davidson, on May the 8th, 2015, when David Cameron came into power on the promise of a referendum on EU membership. And at that stage, science really wasn't in policy. And we thought, because I'd analysed this area, that Brexit would be bad news for UK science. And so I suggested that we set up a new campaign, Scientists for EU, to get the science on the policy map and to put across this point of view. And it immediately took off in the science community, which we later found were about 90% pro-EU from their own sort of experience with working with it. And so the campaign sort of took off from there. And what I'd hoped for the whole referendum campaign wasn't that it would have been as it was, this top-down Westminster bubble where everything was coming from Cameron and the Stronger In campaign. I really thought that it should have been and would have been a society-wide discussion, sector by sector, of those who are for and against discussing all the issues. Because like you said with that recent tweet that we put up, it's complex. It is a complex thing. We've been integrating together over 40 years, and now some people are advocating that we just yank out in two rather than, for example, taking steps down. So it's about British public and British sectors talking to the rest of British public in order to really understand all of the issues so that we can all make competent decisions together.
Yeah, why do you think that didn't happen back in the, I know we're winding the clock back a little bit, but why do you think that didn't happen around the referendum? Is it just the way that the media works? Is it because we didn't understand the EU referendum as a whole, so it was all just led from sort of
two factors.
Questions.
The first factor was that David Cameron thought that he could sew it up quickly. He thought he could do a rush job on the referendum, you know, just have it, you know, 4 months, do it quickly. Bully people over the line on economic fear, sort of like what happened with Scotland. He thought he could pull that off again. As it happened, he was committed to doing a referendum before the end of 2017. So we could still be in the situation now where the referendum hasn't happened yet and we've been having discussion all of this time. But Cameron didn't want that. He wanted to knock it out of the way and then get on with the rest of his agenda. But it all blew up in his face. That was part one. You know, he wanting to rush it and control it from the top. Part two is also how the media works, because the first thing that the media did was to jump in and see it as a Dave versus Boris thing. And all of the commentators that we were seeing across the media, not just the BBC, but also ITV, Channel 4 and all the radio stations, were conservative politicians on the Remain side and on the Leave side, all having a sort of fisticuff within themselves. So it was very much that's what dominated the news, that little soap opera of their claims, when a lot of them were actually very, very light on knowledge. And so there was an error at that level of the media to just play it as they do during, for example, a general election campaign or standard political commentary, just to focus on the major political players rather than wider society. So those are the two levels that I think let all of us down. Whether you voted Leave or whether you voted Remain, you've got to admit it was pretty light on quality information and quality discussion and time to digest it from respected sources, and rather it was just a political free-for-all.
There's a couple of really interesting points you make there. I think that the one point, we've had about 116 episodes now of the Brexit podcast, but you're the first person to actually make the point that the EU referendum need not have actually happened yet, and we could actually be still discussing the finer points.
Yep.
I guess, you know, not something I've massively considered over the past few months either.
Yep. And, I mean, as far as David Cameron was concerned, that was unthinkable. And I know from good sources also that he wanted to have the referendum before the summer and in case there was another immigration crisis. And he also wanted to call it quickly as possible because at the stage when he called it, the Leave campaign was sort of in disarray because you had Leave.eu warring with Vote Leave, and he thought he would take advantage of that. So his decision-making was all about trying to take advantage of circumstances rather than doing what actually should have been done, which is think about the education of the British public. And this is a massive matter, and it should have taken more time because we have been integrating. And this is something that I agree with many Leave advocates on. So, for example, Pete, you know, who recommended me, we've discussed this. You know, if you've been integrating sort of almost under the radar for 40 years because our main media hasn't covered what's been going on with trade deals at the EU level or with mechanical developments at the EU level. When that has been ignored for 40 years, you need some proper time to actually catch up on what's actually been happening.
Yeah, I want to ask you, you know, let's stick with that ahead of the pre-referendum time for a second. You're a scientist and you speak for a body of scientists. What were some of the points that you were trying to get cut through on and some of the important issues on the agenda, which possibly, I guess, are still now key agenda points for you?
Yeah. One of the main things is that the EU is a whole set of different agreements and frameworks, and some, like science, are incredibly successful. So, for example, 34% of the world's scientific output is produced from the EU, 39% from Europe as a whole. America's on 25%, China's on 20%. And the gap between the EU and the US is growing. The EU has also overtaken the US for high quality papers, those in the top 10%. And also in terms of researcher base, we have more scientists than America does, and the gap there is growing as well. And you can talk of Europe and the EU as a whole increasingly because the EU has been the glue that actually invested in us all networking and working together, lowering barriers, but then also from this hub in the EU, reaching out around the world. So in this area of science, it's been a massive success story. It wasn't always the case. When I first got into science policy, my first papers were actually criticizing the EU science program. But then in 2013 and 2014, they really, really started turning things around with the new program. And this is why it has the support of so many British scientists, because we've been leading big multinational projects, sometimes global projects, from that basis, and which means that we're incredibly attractive as a place for people to work from all over the world, because being in that framework, you can lead those multinational projects, and also the UK is driving a whole load of that policy. You know, we were making suggestions, and the other 27 countries were saying, yeah, that sounds good. And so all of the team that we've built, we've now been sort of ripped from, which is actually quite sad. And I hope that we find a way to recover it. Now, there's a lot of people who supported Vote Leave who say, yes, but we can do all of that independently of being in the EU. To a degree, we can buy back into the program, but we don't have the same policy voices before. And also, if we break the freedom of movement agreement, not only does that screw a few things up for us, but it also might mean that we don't get as full of access as we had before. So, yeah. So all we wanted to do during the referendum debate was say, listen, vote however you want to vote, but you need to know about all the different parts of society. Here's ours, science. It's overwhelmingly for the EU, and this is why.
You know, it sounds like there you're talking multinational collaboration, all of these things are key to progress. Can you give me, from a real layman's perspective, can you give me one or two examples of where some of that research has a really positive impact? You know, maybe environment, health. Are there any key points? How you would, I guess you would have to sell your message.
For example, a classic example would be with rare diseases. I mean, some diseases are ultra, ultra rare, which means that you're only going to have a few cases in one country. And that means that if you want to study the things and then develop drugs and treatments for these rare diseases, then you need a bigger patient base. And this is where the 500 million population of the EU comes into play. If you've all got a science program where you can fund these big, you know, 12, 13, 14 nations getting together to research a rare disease, then you can all use the same database. You can actually have patient groups which are pan-European. And then when you're developing drugs, you're actually talking about a market of 500 million, so you can actually make it worthwhile. So, for example, take Genetic Alliance UK. That represents 180 different rare disease patient groups based on, you know, genetic rare diseases. They were campaigning for Remain because overwhelmingly those patient groups saw the benefit of that multinational level research, which is something that you could argue, well, we can do that independently. Oh, really? Through what mechanism? Through what mechanism are you going to get the Swedish government together with the Slovene government, together with the Polish government, together with the Irish government, and get all of them together in a room? But if you've got the EU, then you've already got a framework with it. And if you've got the EU science program, then you've already got funding mechanisms for it. So for things like rare diseases, the whole structure of the EU and EU science program has meant that we've been able to get quality treatments and quality support to people right across the continent, even in those smaller countries that otherwise would be abandoned and neglected.
Yeah, I noticed there's an open letter from Professor Rafael Yanis Munoz on genetic therapy on the Scientist for EU.
So that overlaps with rare disease as well. Yeah,
that's an open letter, because he's refuting some of Boris Johnson's claims.
Yeah, well, he was referring to that Boris Johnson 400-word essay, stroke speech, because it looks like a bit of a speech that he put in the Telegraph, which incidentally was flawed on many counts. Another thing that Boris Johnson did in that letter, he said, when we leave the EU with a stroke of a pen, we can get rid of the tampon tax. The tampon tax was already sorted back in May 2016 before the referendum. The EU already agreed, yeah, sure, if you want to get rid of that, you can. And then the hyperlink that Boris Johnson gave to that tampon tax thing was to another piece in the Telegraph that said, complaining about the tampon tax is ridiculous. So Boris Johnson's whole piece was a mess on many fronts. But yes, on this gene therapy front as well, it's just him spouting something with absolutely no backup as to why that would be the case. And for sure, this guy, as he said in his letter, talked to lots and lots of colleagues to ask, what do you think Boris Johnson's talking about when he says gene therapy specifically? And they're all like, well, I don't know. Just talking. I don't know what language I can use on this podcast, but you get the idea.
I was pretty liberal. You can go for whatever you like.
Yeah, well, he's talking wank, isn't he? I mean, but he has form in this area, so it's no surprise.
Now, on the front of your website, you've got a blog that says "Keep Us in Euratom." Euratom was a subject that certainly hit the media headlines probably about three or four months ago. Can you give us you're the scientist. Can you give us a brief overview of what Euratom is, why it's important, and why we need to stay in it?
Sure. So Euratom was one of the original treaties back in 1957. So we've been in it for 60 years now. And originally it was to cover development of nuclear research and nuclear expertise, stop proliferation of nuclear weapons, ensure safety in terms of use, in terms of disposal, also in terms of medical isotopes, also in terms of intellectual property. And through that framework, we also have agreements with other countries around the world, like America and South Africa and Korea and Japan, I believe. I'm not sure about those last two, but eight countries around the world. Now, what happened over time was that Latin stayed its own independent treaties, but it became governed by the mechanisms of the EU. So decisions on it being made by the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers, and also the European Court of Justice became the oversight mechanism. Now, so what happened specifically with Brexit and Euratom is that we had inquiries about what leaving the EU would mean for science. We had two big inquiries, one just before the vote, one just after, House of Lords and House of Commons. Both of those had dozens of submissions into them. Neither of them mentioned the possibility of leaving Euratom. It was just off the radar. No one thought that that was a serious option. But then, when Theresa May put forward her Article 50 bill, it was put there in the small print that leaving the EU means leaving Euratom. And this caused immediate consternation in the science research community, because there's science research tied to this, as well as the nuclear industry community, which has some 78,000 employees. And the overwhelming view was kind of like, you don't need to do that. Now, the view from the government was, well, because the two treaties are so linked and their structures are linked, then leaving one means leaving the other. This is disputed by other lawyers. But then it was claimed by the government's own business committee that the reason that Theresa May had said we're leaving Euratom comes down to it being under the oversight of the European Court of Justice, and this is one of her red lines, therefore let's just yank us out.
Mm.
Now, the problem is that then leaves you with three options. One, fix it yourself in 2 years. Two, try to get an associate membership pretty darn quick. Or three, go back on what you just did. With trying to fix it ourselves, it's the judgment of the nuclear industry, and the Nuclear Institute is one representative of that. You just can't do it in 2 years. Set everything up that means that you keep all of the international frameworks. You can't do those deals in time. So then you could ask for an associate membership. This isn't really an off-the-shelf thing that you can get. It takes negotiations, and we only get onto negotiations after we settle the divorce bill. So you can see how that causes uncertainty and then might not even come through if we crash out. And so then the third option, which we think is the smartest one, is just to say, you know what, we said we're pulling out of Euratom. We want to go back on that and undo it. Let us stay in until, you know, so long as we can be making payments and we're under the European Court of Justice for now. Surely this is something that we can sort out a few years down the line with everyone's good grace and agreement, and that means that business as usual can carry on for our nuclear sector and we don't have those threats. So that's what all of that is about.
And what chance do you think there is of Theresa May saying, do you know what, shouldn't have put it in Article 50, let's reverse that decision, let's stay in Euratom. Is it going to happen?
There is a chance, but it is low, because the problem with Brexit at the moment is that there has been so much piled on the government's plate, from leaving free movement, to leaving the single market, to leaving Euratom, to leaving the customs union, that's a big one, which also impacts on Ireland, to all the healthcare frameworks and citizens' rights. There's so much piled up on the plate to do in less than 2 years now that things will be falling off the plate. I think the greatest likelihood is that even though we will fight this because we want to keep stability in this area, at least for the moment, the risk is things will fall off the plate and we will just be out of certain frameworks for a while and have to do emergency patch-ups.
Which is
a shame. There's also political blockage, you see, because if you say we'd like to take back our Article 106A notification, which is the Euratom one, then that gets agreed through Parliament, and then the hardcore Brexiteers then obviously get very nervous that if you're recalling that notification, that you then might do that with Article 50 itself. So they would probably rather see our nuclear industry sort of crash and burn a bit or take that risk rather than, you know, have a stepping stone to jeopardising their whole project as they prefer it.
Mm.
So, yeah, this is the weird territory that we're into.
When people think of the nuclear industry, they might think about defence, missiles, or that type of thing, and power perhaps. But there are there's things like medical equipment supplies and isotopes, and this all comes into it, doesn't it? And some of the things that are used in hospitals that are actually on the front line saving lives. So it's very broad ranging.
Yes, absolutely, and that's something that has been flagged up repeatedly and also disputed by the government. Because the government has pointed out that Euratom strictly covers, with strict regulations, the fissile material for nuclear reactors. But there are also safety issues with just radioisotopes, you know, in case they get used in dirty bombs and things like that. So it's a complex and messy landscape.
Mike, where are you now with everything? Do you feel that scientists, where you're building up a head of steam? Do you feel that you're being listened to? I mean, do you have numbers, for example, how many sort of scientists are in your corner?
Oh yeah, I mean the vast majority of scientists are fundamentally pro EU. So early in the referendum debate, there was a poll done by the Campaign for Science and Engineering with the Engineering Professors Council, I think it was, and found that 93% of scientists and engineers, research scientists and engineers, thought the EU was a major benefit to UK research. There was a poll done by Nature magazine that found that 85% of UK scientists, I think it was, planned to vote Remain. And then there have been polls in the higher education sector showing that, you know, 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 in the higher education sector were for Remain. So also there was the letter from 150 Royal Society members, including Stephen Hawking, that was all for Remain, as well as over 100 vice-chancellors of UK universities for Remain. And there wasn't a single vice-chancellor in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland or Wales that actually advocated leave. Because we work in this international framework, and the European framework, it's not just the EU. I mean, there's other parts of the European framework, like the European Space Agency or CERN, but the whole European framework and every part of it has been majorly beneficial. So scientists are vastly, overwhelmingly on that side, as also a House of Lords inquiry found. So, there's no doubt about that, that the science community sort of globally it tends to sort of think as one, about teamwork, international teamwork, and facilitating immigration for science and mobility. So that's not in question. The question is how much trust we get from the public in terms of when we say that we want to be in these international frameworks, it's actually for everyone's benefit, not just our benefit. The point of being in these frameworks is greater efficiency for the health, for environmentalism, for our universities, which spin out businesses into their local communities. And when those businesses grow, that's jobs for everyone because they're growing businesses. Now, all this healthy ecosystem, we need the public to realize that this is good for our economy and good for our quality of life. So that's one challenge. And then the other challenge is getting British science on the radar with these Brexit discussions, because that's a deal that needs to be struck for the benefit of our universities, our small innovation and tech businesses. And so if we've got this threat of pulling out with no deal because we don't want to pay the money that we said we were going to pay at the beginning of this financial program and we want to pull the plug now, if we get no deal, then that means no deal on health, no deal on science, no deal on tech and data, no deal on financial passporting, and a whole range of other issues as well. And that's a problem. So we're trying to raise awareness because most people, regardless of how they voted, generally understand that collaboration is good and international collaboration is good and frameworks of collaboration are good. And so we have to get people back to that point where you say, right, okay, and we could lose everything that we built from 40 years. So surely it makes sense for all of us to want to recapture a lot of those productive frameworks. And science is a leading one. We have now in this country put science central to our industrial strategy. That's what the government has done, and they're right to do so, but it hurts us a lot if we can't play in all the frameworks that we used to run.
Mike, just you may not be able to answer this one as such, but you probably have a good idea. It sounds fair that the science community is quite fluid across Europe, perhaps across the world as well. How many UK scientists would you think are working on the continent currently? And I guess a hard Brexit and the end of freedom of movement potentially puts what they're doing in jeopardy.
Less so. I don't know numbers across the continent. But in terms of Brits abroad, they'll probably be quite happy abroad, because if they're still in the EU, then it still means that they, from those other countries, can lead multinational projects. And also, if they feel welcome in those countries, then they'll be very happy to stay there and bring up families there. The problem we found in the science community here now is that since the Brexit vote, EU citizens, even those working in science in our labs, feel unwelcome here. Not in the labs, but in the wider society. When they go out about town, they're very aware of, you know, their accents. And if people are going to ask them where they're from or tell them to go back home, and you do get incidents of all of that. And so it makes them nervous about being here. If they don't like the tone that they see when they walk down the street and they look at all the tabloid press, immigrants this, immigrants eating our NHS and killing our babies or whatever, the Daily Mail and Daily Express are putting out now, then it gets them upset. And they also don't want to bring up their children here. So it's harder for our universities now to be recruiting people from the rest of the EU. And that's a real cultural problem for us at the moment. And our government isn't helping. I heard a few weeks back Damien Green on the radio, Radio 4 in the morning, saying, of course we have to leave the freedom of movement framework because, you know, immigrants depress wages and strain services. But someone like him, who should know better, is actually saying things like that. Now, just to address those two points, in terms of straining services, we know EU immigrants bring in more money than they cost, so they pay their way, then add more money to prop up the rest of us in those services. And in terms of depressing wages, there was one study that non-EU immigrants help reduce wages at the lower end a small amount. So that's got nothing to do with free movement. But if you think that millions of people are listening to Damien Green on Radio 4, if you're an EU immigrant listening to that and you know it's wrong and you know you're contributing to society, but you know that Brits are listening to this message, you get angry, you get resentful, you feel unwanted, and you're more likely to look for jobs elsewhere. If you feel the whole country has this attitude towards immigrants.
Do you see any positives to the decision for Brexit?
There's one very big one, which is the education. to come back to what we had before, I know lots of people who say there never should have been a referendum debate, and that was Cameron's mistake. No, there needed to be something like this, because at the time when it was called, only 8% of the population felt as though they knew how the EU worked. That's untenable to go on like that. So given that we've voted how we have voted, we are now getting the nuts and bolts education that we never had about the customs union, about the single market, about mechanisms of immigration, about GRATM, about health frameworks and data protection frameworks. All of these different things, we're actually getting the education. Yes, we may get hurt badly by Brexit. In a democracy, you have absolutely the right to vote how you want to go and take that hit if there's a hit coming with it. And the rest of Europe have certainly learned and had the education from what we're doing as well. They've learned more about the customs union and single market and all these other frameworks as well. So that is something that, even though it's a very, very expensive lesson, in my view, is actually a lesson for all of Europe from the Brexit experience so far. In terms of opportunities for this country, I don't see many. A lot of the opportunities that were sold to the science community, like, well, now you can go and collaborate with the rest of the world, were actually false opportunities, because we do a lot of collaboration with the rest of the world through the EU Science Programme, because it's actually a global programme, and it never kept us from working with other people, rather it facilitated it. So in science, there really aren't benefits. Maybe within life sciences, there's opportunities for us to write some of our own regulations in areas such as genetic modification or stem cell research, for example. But the advantage you can gain on that is vanishing, given that you've got more power by actually having the same regulations as your 27 neighbours, so that you can do cross-border collaboration with that. So I've tried to think a lot of times about opportunities. I mean, the biggest opportunity I could see for science and European science and global science from Brexit would be if we were to stay in the single market, stay in the customs union, keep a looser form of freedom of movement, so therefore be in the EU science programme, and encourage the EU science programme to loosen itself a bit from the EU, so that it's more of its own independent programme, pan-European, and then you get the Swiss policy voice in there and the Norwegian policy voice in there. So it's been cooked up in the EU nest and then somewhat flies the nest a bit. But that requires a lot of good faith and a lot of trust between nations to get to that stage. And we're very, very far away from doing that at the moment, if what we're talking about is much harder version of Brexit or even the full walk away. All of that is aggressive and damaging stuff. I mean, you can say we're leaving the EU, but we're not leaving Europe. Yeah, prove it. So what are we doing and keeping in Europe other than being geographically in Europe? If you're not thinking about how you build frameworks within Europe, then that's meaningless.
Michael, my final question, I was going to ask you to outline what your optimal solution would be for the Brexit process, but I think you've just done that very eloquently. So I guess, yeah. Ben, just finally.
I mean, to have a quick word on that, I think at the moment the hard Brexiteers are blowing it a bit, because after the referendum, then there is all the re-leavers, a bunch of Remainers who said, OK, fine, we accept the result and we just want to see a softer version of Brexit. And there was a bunch of Brexiteers that were all for the Norway model and staying in the single market and customs union, at least if you're one of the Frexit people like Pete North, for a while to find your feet and move on from there. If the Brexiteers had stuck with that line, saying, look, leave one, therefore we're leaving, it was 52-48, therefore we'll make a cautious step first and then see how the public feels, come out of the EU, but stay in that framework, and then see from there if we want to go further, then that would be extremely hard to argue with. As it happens, they wanted to lock the door, swallow the key, burn down the house, pull us out of absolutely everything to make sure that we can't come back into anything. And this is why a lot of those Remainers that were accepting before are now moving to stop Brexit. This is going completely off the rails.
I see. Thank you. And then I guess, just very finally, if people want to find out more about your work, Scientists for EU, what you do, can you point them in the right direction, please?
Yeah, just look up Scientists for EU on Facebook and on Twitter.
Great. Simple as. Dr. Mike Gorsley, thank you for joining us today on the Brexit podcast.
Thanks very much for having me. That's it.
And great. Thank you. The Brexit podcast has been brought to you by Tim Hemming, Jennifer Hahn, and Holly Dagmore, and the music is by...